KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in Forum's second hour, author Michael Lewis will be joining us to talk about his newest book, The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game. And you don't need to be a football fan to appreciate the tale he weaves in this new book, observations he makes about the changing nature of pay and positions of importance in the gridiron game. Forum is next with your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Michael Lewis has given us the best-selling books Liar's Poker, The New Thing, and Moneyball. His work also appears regularly in the New York Times Magazine and Bloomberg News. And his newest book is all about football, the way the game has changed, and the importance of the position of left tackle, the lineman who protects the blind side of the quarterback. But the book is also a spotlight on an indigent man-child of Memphis poverty named Michael Orr and the frenzy that takes place over this young, enormous black teenager who becomes the most highly sought football lineman in the nation. Michael Lewis's newest book is called The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game, and he joins us for this morning's second hour. Good to see you.
Well, it's nice to be back.
Good to have you back. Well, let's begin actually where you begin. We begin with Joe Theismann and also with Lawrence Taylor. By the way, I noticed the dedication. Is that Lawrence Taylor in the dedication?
No, it's Starling Lawrence, who's the editor-in-chief of W.W. Norton.
I thought maybe you were calling Lawrence Taylor by his first name or giving him the adjective Starling.
Other than a certain ferocity, they have nothing in common.
But this is about the changes in the game, and it's also an extraordinary sociological and cultural story. I didn't know that they still count one Mississippi, two Mississippi. But Lawrence Taylor, let's start with him, because he transformed the game in many ways, just who he was and what he did as a linebacker.
Absolutely. There were two things that drew me to this story, and one was I didn't understand how it could be that this guy on the offensive line, the left tackle, had become the second highest paid player in the NFL behind the quarterback. No one knows who he is. The camera's never on him. He never touches the ball. He's been a total obscurity. And 20 years ago, he wasn't. 20 years ago, he was the lowest play, along with the other lineman, the lowest paid guy. But Lawrence Taylor happened. Lawrence Taylor and people like Lawrence Taylor, and they were people who were especially lethal pass rushers coming off the blind side of the quarterback, the blind side being for a right-handed quarterback. So, and this fellow, the left tackle's job is to keep them off the quarterback. Taylor was, in his day, maybe in any day, the most dominant defensive player
in any day, yeah,
ever. I mean, he showed that you could change a game from that side of the ball. And that as the passing game got more and more important in football, that if you had someone who could do what Lawrence Taylor did, you could completely disrupt the opposition, and which explained why on the other side of the ball that you needed this freak who could keep Lawrence Taylor off your quarterback. That was that was part of my interest in this story.
The story begins with Lawrence Taylor putting Joe Theismann out of commission and making him no longer able to do his job as a quarterback ever. I mean,
well, that's right.
Career.
The first chapter is the famous scene on Monday Night Football where Lawrence Taylor goes over Joe Theismann's back and breaks his leg in two places. And it's so violent they could hear it on the side, the bones snap on the sidelines.
Stop there for a second, because the brutality actually can really bother a reader as it did me. I mean, Lawrence Taylor, is a football hero, but he says, I want to get these guys so bad that when they're holding up seven fingers, they're only seeing three. In other words, the sense of the brutality and what he wants to do to quarterbacks, the aggression behind it.
You can't repeat most of
it. I don't want to sermonize on this, but I mean, it's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And they had, the funny thing is, the Giants defense in that day got so routinely put quarterbacks out of the game that they just assumed they might do it before every game. And before this particular game, they sat down and met, and they asked Lawrence Taylor not to put Joe Theismann out of the game because he actually wasn't that good anymore, and they'd like to keep him in. So they had in the back of their minds they were trying to keep this guy in the game when it happened.
But you could even see Lawrence Taylor on the sidelines and get full of fright. I mean, quarterbacks did.
Right. What was odd about this particular episode is Lawrence Taylor himself was disturbed by it, and I didn't understand. I talked to Taylor about it, and I didn't understand why he got so worked up about it, because, in fact, a lot of times he was explicitly going after him. He was trying to kill the quarterback, and he succeeded in doing it. Why, when he got up on Monday Night Football, was he kind of clasping his helmet and jumping up and down in agony? And he told me, he said, actually, it was an odd thing. He's I'm claustrophobic. He said I've always had this fear of being on the bottom of a big pile and being hurt and not being able to get out. And he was on the bottom of this pile with Joe Theismann, and blood was spurting everywhere, and he'd heard the bone snap. And for a brief moment, he empathized with his victim and kind of got inside of his skin. And I said to Lawrence Taylor, I don't think of you being afraid of anything. And he said, we all have fears. And that's the beginning of the book, because you don't think of fear as being really a factor. You think of anybody on a pro football field, they're not scared. They're there because they aren't scared. But, in fact, fear is all over the football field. And the reason this position gets so valuable in football, the left tackle position, is he is an antidote to the biggest fear, the fear that this guy is going to come off and kill your quarterback and do this kind of damage to your quarterback. But that was really a subplot to the book. I mean, the book
is... Well, yeah, because from there we go to a fellow named Lemming. And let me take our listeners there with you. Tom Lemming is a guy, sort of sui generis, a guy who looks at these videotapes and has people clamoring to get their football player from high school looked at, because he's the guy that selects the All-American high school football team. And a kind of Lewis and Clark enterprise, he describes himself as, going 60,000, 70,000 miles a year, just traveling all across the country looking for... Suddenly somebody sends him a grainy videotape, and it intrigues him. He's never seen the likes of this. And he's looking for who this guy is. I mean, because there's always kind of a surfeit of information on who these people are. And he can find so little about him. I mean, it's an intriguing story just as it begins there.
Well, here's a fellow who's been for 25 years interviewing 2,000 high school football players a year looking for talent. And he's extraordinarily accurate in predicting careers. Most of the people he picks, unless they get into trouble with crime or drugs or something derails them that way, a lot of them end up in the NFL. And he sees this tape of this kid in Memphis, and he's never heard of the kid. The kid's name is Michael Orr. And he can't believe what he's seeing on the tape. A combination of size and speed he just can't imagine is really that the tape is telling the truth. And he sets up a visit to Memphis to go meet this kid, and he can't find the kid. The kid has no address. He has no phone number. Nobody says, according to the school, he has no home address. Through the school, he sets up a meeting with the kid.
And it's a Christian school, we should mention.
It's the Briarcrest Christian School. That's right, an evangelical Christian school in Memphis. That's mainly, the students are almost all white, and Michael Orr is black. So it's odd already. And he said when Michael Orr walked into the room, it was like a house walking into a bigger house. That he said he was big in every way, and he was clearly fast. You could tell from the video, but he was not completely non-communicative and seemed totally disinterested in football. And because Lemming was there to ask him if he would play on in his high school All-American game, the U.S. Army All-Star game, which every football player in America wants to be in. And Michael Orr just looked at him, didn't say anything, and walked out the room. And that was that. And so there was this great mystery. But what Lemming did is he wrote him up in this newsletter that he sends to Division I college coaches and said, I think I've found the best left tackle prospect since Orlando Pace, who currently starts for the St. Louis Rams.
He found him as a Sandusky Sizzler,
that's
as
right.
I recall.
That's right. He found him as a Sandusky Sizzler, and who is now making $8 million a year for the St. Louis Rams. And he was perplexed by it. He thought the kid had some kind of disorder or problem. He was going to be trouble. He didn't know what to do with the kid, but he couldn't ignore this talent that he saw in him.
Forgive me, talking to roughly, I think you say, quote, let me say, 40 to 50,000 football players, he never ever had an incident like this where somebody was just totally silent.
He never once had an incident where a player refused to fill in his forms and certainly never had an incident where a player showed no interest whatsoever in playing in the high school All-American game. He never had anything like this happen to him ever. But he still mentions the kid in this newsletter he sends to the college coaches. And almost all the Division I schools get his newsletter. And so at the Briarcrest Christian School practice that spring, which is the spring before Michael Orr's senior year, five assistant coaches from big-time college schools show up. And this is very unusual at the Briarcrest Christian School. They don't see college football coaches very often. And they asked to see Michael in action. And they put Michael, who is 6 foot, 5.5 inches, 350 pounds, on the end of one of a board. And on the other end of the board, they put the biggest kid on the team they can find, a kid named Joseph Crone, who weighed 270 pounds. And they blew the whistle, and they went at each other. And Michael essentially picked him up and took him 15 yards back and pancaked him. And all the coaches instantly went on their phones and said to their bosses, you got to get here and see this. And by the end of their spring practice, virtually every school in the country had been through the Briarcrest Christian School. And it was a frenzy. And you had you had a kid who was the most highly sought after lineman in the country, and it happened overnight. I mean, it happened over a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. And the amazing thing was, until that happened, the kid did not think he was a football player. He'd played on the team for 1 year. He had come from a background that poverty doesn't describe. It. The word poverty. He was essentially lived on the streets of Memphis for the first 15 years of his life. Had not really played much organized. Anything.
One of 13 kids and a mother a crack addict?
That's right. His mother was addicted to crack. She had 13 children by 8 or 9 different men, was unable to care for them. The fathers all vanished. The kids raised themselves, living out of garbage cans and soup kitchens and all the rest. Michael had been to 11 or 12 different schools by the time he's in ninth grade, and he seldom showed up there. On his trans-school transcripts, it showed him repeating first grade, repeating second grade, and then vanishing from school altogether until the end of fourth grade. And when he showed up at the Briarcrest Christian School, he's supposedly a sophomore in high school, but he can't read or write. He has an IQ of 80. He's never had a book read to him or obviously read a book. He's had no experience whatsoever outside of this little postage stamp of inner city Memphis. And he encounters first the school and then a family in the school named the Tuohys, who end up adopting him. And they're rich. They're rich. They're white. They're evangelical. And they know sports. The dad was a great basketball player in college. And they drown him in nurture. And the big story in the book is really the transformation of Michael Orr. What happens when you take a kid who's had absolutely no nurture and at the age of 15, 16, 17, drown him in it? The possibilities that come from that, and I mean the possibilities are I mean what happens?
Chris, he's
kid?
A gentle and
he's a gentle and sweet kid.
Sweet kid to begin with.
He's a gentle and sweet kid to begin with, but his IQ goes up between 20 and 30 points. He learns to read and write. He learns to function in the world. He can have a conversation with you now before he could not, and he discovers organized sports.
Even before football, he was throwing the discus and playing basketball. I mean, it was kind of a natural physical.
Well, this was grace. It was a funny thing because this monster. I mean, he's a monster of a kid. Wanders into this school and they don't know what to make of him. And the book explains how he wanders into the school, but it's completely flukish that he's taken into this school. And the coaches, have never seen anything like it in their school. I mean, he is unusual by any standards, but certainly by the standards of this small private school in Memphis. And the first coach who saw him and kind of wondered, what is this, was the basketball coach. You have to imagine the shape, 6'5", 6'6", 350 pounds. It's not a basketball body. Put it in perspective, Shaquille O'Neal is, 7'2", or 7'1", and he weighs 330 or 320. So that you're talking about a very wide, wide body. The basketball coach tossed the kid a basketball on the court one day as he was just walking along in his street clothes. And the kid took it and dribbled between his legs 3 times, went out to the three-point line, spun, and hit a three-point shot. And the basketball coach went, oh, my God, that's not how that body is supposed to move. The track coach saw him wander onto the football field during football practice. In the first year this kid is in the school, he's not allowed to play any sports because he's flunking all his classes, and he's basically, they think they're going to end up throwing him out of the school. He's not qualified to play the sports, but he wanders onto the football field and finds there's a sack of footballs the football team uses to practice, and the football team's off doing its calisthenics. And he's on the 50-yard line. He takes the balls out of the bag and one by one throws them through the goalposts. So the balls are going 70, 75 yards, and a good college quarterback arm is 60 or 70 yards. I mean, And so the track coach takes him, the minute he becomes qualified, the track coach takes him literally by the hand out the back door of the school to the school's first track meet, which is in the backyard, and says, puts him in the line of kids to throw the discus. And the kid doesn't even know what a discus is. And Michael gets to the front of the line having watched the other kids throw the discus. And in the first throw, he wins the meet. And 3 months later, he broke the West Tennessee sectional record for the discus throw. And I'm told by people who know a lot more about this than me that if he wanted to be a serious discus athlete, that he could throw the discus, you know, big time.
Well, way you describe it, also, he gets the spinning. He gets the right physical movements. It's almost as he learns it just by nature.
He had an incredible ability to watch what people were doing and emulate it. He just watched the little kids in front of him throw the discus. And he did what they did. And the problem was the little kids in front of him in that particular meet didn't actually know all the technique. But when he got into more competitive meets, the people actually knew what they were doing, and he was emulating a finer and finer discus throwing specimen. And so he got better and better at it. But the football coach sees him. He comes through the football practice again. He walks across the field, and he picks up a 60- or 70-pound tackling dummy, and he starts to run with it, and it was like it didn't exist. And the football coach, of course, starts to salivate. So he gets put on the football team his junior year. But then the story's very murky and odd, because they assume that someone so fast and big should be playing defense, and they put him on the defense. And he didn't know where to go. He was kind of confused a lot of the time. And he wasn't aggressive. He didn't actually seem to want to go hit people. And he was end up being benched for part of the year. He didn't even play that much his junior year. So when he gets written up by Tom Lemming, and before you know it, every coach in the country is coming through the Briarcrest Christian School saying, we need this kid. Everybody's perplexed. They think they're
going to see a left tackle, right?
They don't know what they don't have any. Well, the people at Briarcrest are perplexed. They think they had no idea he was that good. But the coaches are looking at something. They know what they're seeing. They're seeing a left tackle in the NFL. Nick Saban, who was the coach of LSU at the time, is now the coach of the Miami Dolphins, went through and made a very serious effort to try to talk Michael into going to LSU. And he said that, look, if this kid isn't a first-round draft pick in the NFL 3 years from now, if he isn't a top 15 pick in the first round, he's either got hurt or someone's done something wrong to him, because you just don't see this very often.
Talking to Michael Lewis again, his new book is
The Blind Side.
The Blind Side, The Evolution of a Game. And, you know, the other thing, I mean, this is an extraordinary story about Michael Orr. It's a mythic story, really, almost, about a gifted athlete. And I got caught up in it. But it's also a story about these people, the nurturers, as you put them. I mean, here are these right-wing, evangelical, conservative, I mean, certainly good-hearted people, though, and compassionate people.
Very good-hearted and very compassionate people.
And the woman, particularly Anne, I mean, is a mother to him. I mean, he responds to her much more than he does to Sean, the husband.
No, Sean is the husband, and Leanne is the wife. And Sean will tell you that even now, Michael doesn't tell him things. That Leanne pretty instantly became mommy. And how that happens is, I mean, I tell you, it's the Pygmalion story, and from her point of view, that she loved this kid, but she was going to hammer him into shape like she hammered her own kids into shape. She kind of took him in by the ear, by the scruff of the neck.
Comes across a very tough lady.
But it all starts literally on the streets. Sean had met this kid at the school because their kids are at the school, and they'd had some interaction, but he didn't think much about it. And Leanne and Sean were driving down the streets of Memphis one day during Thanksgiving break of that first year the kid is at school, and Michael is at school, sophomore year, and they see this monster get off the city bus in shorts and a T-shirt, and it's snowing. And Leanne, and Sean says, oh, that's the kid I was telling you about. And Leanne says, but Sean, he's wearing shorts and it's snowing. And Sean didn't think anything of it, but they pulled over and Sean introduced Leanne to Michael. And she said, what are you doing in shorts out in the snow? And he says, I'm going to the school gym. And he wasn't allowed to play any sports. And in any case, the school gym wasn't functioning. The kids were all off. And
so but there was heat there.
That's what she said. What you go? Why are you going there? And he said, they got heat there. Yeah. And he was looking just to keep warm. She essentially put him in the car and took him out shopping for clothes. And this was interesting. She couldn't find anything to fit him in the entire city that properly fit. And she called Sean and said, do you know how big a 58 long jacket is? And he said, how long? She said, not long, not big enough. Leanne is an interior decorator, and she has a number of professional athlete clients. And she thought, I'll get some of these professional football players to give me their hand-me-downs because, you know, I'll get clothes from there. And she called, one of her clients was Patrick Ramsey, who was then the quarterback of the Washington Redskins. She called Patrick Ramsey, gave him his specifications, 52-inch waist, 20-inch neck, 40-inch sleeves, all these numbers that she'd gotten off Michael, and told him to go to talk to some of the players and see if he could get hand-me-down clothes. And Ramsey called her back a couple of days later and said, you got the measurements wrong. And she didn't have the measurements wrong. And he said, Leanne, we don't have anybody in the Washington Redskins who's as big as he is. And he was 15 or just turned 16 years old. But she, over time, creeps into every aspect of his life. Soon she's taken care. He'd never been to the hospital before. He gets hurt. She takes him to the hospital for the first time, covers the hospital. He has no place to sleep.
Got terrified of a needle, too.
Yeah. He had to have a shot. He'd never seen a shot. In fact, he goes on and on about white people, and they don't understand how they overuse the medical system. He's the second year they tried to give him a flu shot. He said, you white people got something. What's going on with the flu shot? You don't need a flu shot every year.
Speaking about white people, I mean, Leanne came from a very racist father. I mean, even at the wedding between her and Sean, a lot of black people, because he played basketball, and the father comes in and uses
all the N-word. What are they all doing here is what he said. Father was a U.S. Marshal in Memphis, and he was terrified and hated black people, and she was raised with the same views. Now, she married a man who grew up surrounded by black people and who, as she says, he doesn't see his own color. He doesn't know his own color, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. At their wedding, a lot of his black teammates were at the wedding, and the father just couldn't put up with it. So she at some point, she doesn't actually explain to me ever how, but at some point she starts to think this is one of God's tests, that this is one of the tests God sets up for people. She thinks money is a test. God gives you money to see how you're going to handle it. And she thinks the race thing, as she puts it, is a test. God put it out there to see how you're going to deal with it. And Leanne is about passing tests. That, you know, give her a test and she'll pass it. And so she was very... in a funny way, that the family, one of the reasons this has worked so well in this family is that neither Michael nor the Tuohy family, who adopts him, really see color. They don't really think in terms of race. It's not on the surface of their lives. It's on the surface of everyone else's lives. 6 months into her moving into their lives, she puts him in their Christmas card with her two kids. She has a daughter the same age and a younger son. Sends it out without telling anybody. 400 people who, of course, they hadn't seen in the last year. Weeks later, she didn't get any response. Weeks later, she gets a call from her cousin in North Carolina, and he says, it's late at night. He says, all right, I just had my fifth beer. Who the hell is this black kid in your Christmas card?
We're going to have to go to a break. When we come back, your phone calls and emails. In fact, you can join us with Michael Lewis if you care to, and we invite you to do so and welcome your calls. Toll free, 866-733-6786. Please join this conversation if you would like to do so. Again, the toll free number, 866-733-6786, if you'd like to talk to Michael Lewis. Or you can email us, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. The book is called The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny talking this hour with Michael Lewis. His book is called The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game, and probably many of you know him through other books of his, Moneyball, The New Thing, and his writing appears certainly on a fairly regular basis in the New York Times Magazine and Bloomberg News, and your calls are welcome. Again, you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum at kqed.org. And The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game, is about the changing nature of football, but it is also about a very poignant and moving story about a young man named Michael Orr, who was, as Michael Lewis puts it, a lot of Michaels here, taken in by a Christian family in Memphis and given a great deal of love and nurturing. And so it becomes a story of nature-nurture in some ways. Also, before I go to calls here, I always, when I read a story like this, I always think brain and brawn. I mean, you can't help thinking brain and brawn, right? Football is more, in some ways, a challenging. People think I'm, you know, the cerebral guy, but the fact is I played football. I really actually love the game. And it's a complicated game, much more than people realize. When you're looking at plays and you're looking at strategy and tactics.
This shocked me about football. You know, I went from Moneyball right into writing a piece about football. It was the first time I'd ever been in an NFL locker room. And I was shocked by how articulate and intelligent all the football players were. They put the baseball players to shame. And this
they're all college graduates to begin with, though. That shouldn't
that's
be
well, no, but that's part of it. The filter is finer. That's absolutely right. Almost all of them have gone to college, but to play the game at that level, you have to be smart enough to know the plays, and the play it is complicated. And it's true. I think it's true that you can't be too stupid to play baseball, but you can really be too stupid to play football. And my main character, Michael Orr, when he walks into the Briarcrest Christian School, is widely believed to be too stupid to play football. And he certainly, he's so confused about everything and incapable of kind of decisive action that he seems sort of temperamentally incapable of it too. And so the nurture of his, of the nurture he received and the education he received end up kind of being, I think, central to his football success. I don't think he'd have done what he's done on the football field if Leanne Toohey had not taken him in hand and insisted that he learn how to read, learn how to function, develop a kind of presence, a sense of confidence in the world. They're all related. The two things are related. The book does trace this very specific change in the game, why it was that this position, the left tackle, got to be so valuable. And when you see the history of that, you see how complex it is. I mean, Bill Walsh is at the center of it in some ways because it partly has to do with how the passing game got more important. But there's an intellectual side to football.
Don playing the role of the quarterback, too, yeah.
In a way, it made the quarterback more valuable because the passing game was more important. But he made the quarterback's job a lot more routine.
Yeah. I'm also, just to add to the motif about the intelligence required in football, first time I ever taught a course, I had a young man whose name will remain anonymous for now who went on to play professional football, and he was brought into Wisconsin, African-American kid, poor, reminded me of Michael Orr in some ways. Could barely write, was barely literate. It was a real problem. They had tutors and so forth because obviously they wanted to get him through. And yet knew his playbook. When he was on the field, concentration was maximum. I mean, it was like almost dealing with two different people. There was a sort of fear about academic learning.
Right.
And that was a big part of it. But there was also just a lack of education, a lack of schooling, really, literally.
Right.
But when he was on the field, you know,
he was confident.
He was confident. He was intelligent. He was concentrating, and he, like I said, he knew his playbook.
Right. Well, in Michael's case, he couldn't be confident on the field until he was confident off the field for whatever reason, and this required it wasn't just classroom book learning. It required Leanne Toohey to make him essentially at home in rich white Christian Memphis. And so you had her doing things. I mean, she would do things like the first time they went out to a restaurant, she realized he was paralyzed with fear. She says, you don't know how complicated it all is if you've never done it in your whole life. And so she instantly takes him out to an Italian restaurant and orders the entire menu, puts it all out along with all the different kinds of cutlery they have, and they have a course. This is fettuccine Alfredo. This is pesto. And she would turn on the TV set and find a golf game and she wouldn't let him stop watching until he knew the difference between a par and a bogey. I mean, in a way, it was very reflective of the world they lived in, but she wanted him to feel comfortable in that world.
Republican country club world.
That's exactly right. But she understood that the difference between there's a difference between stupidity and ignorance. They're not the same thing, but people mistake them. And if you are ignorant in their world, you can be made to feel awfully uncomfortable. And so she allayed his ignorance. And as she did that, he just came out of his shell. He became comfortable with himself. And it was at basically precisely the moment he became comfortable with himself that became very comfortable on a football field, too.
And let's go to our callers. And we begin with a caller from New York. David, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I was. There was a book mentioned on your show last week, "A Flesh and Stone," but it kind of relates to this. In the book, he has a character. I don't know if it's a real guy. He claims it's an actual person. He has a guy that was whose mom was a prostitute who was actually born in jail, and he was born. He was about 17 pounds, and he grew up to be about 6'11", 360 pounds. And his IQ was just so low, he couldn't even follow instructions on the football field. He went to a high school in New Jersey. But he was able to actually bend quarters with his hands. And I heard he's in Europe in some type of sideshow right now.
Well, I haven't run across this fellow.
No, don't know anything about him. But thanks, David, for bringing that to our attention. Let me get some more of our callers. Richard, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
Michael, first of all, I really enjoy just your different work, and I've read a number of your books, and I really appreciate the insight that you bring, especially kind of the Southern wit and charm to your work.
That's always a nice way to introduce a question. Thank you.
Sure. Just as a little background, I mean, I'm from Texas, and I'm a huge college football fan. And I think the part that in the New York Times excerpt that I read that really kind of resonated with me was, you know, yet again, we have a story of somebody that if Michael was 6 feet shorter or was 50 pounds lighter or not as quick on his feet, yet another kid just kind of passing his way, passed along through school, no prospects, no education, no, you know, just another African-American life that just kind of wasted. And I wish if you could just kind of comment for a minute a little bit on that, maybe what you saw in investigating the story in the South on this sense that if you're poor and you're black and you don't have a talent, you can't play, you can't be the quarterback, you're not a running back, you can't play the low post in basketball. There's a sense that you're invisible and you're really not of value to the white community. I mean, that's something that I almost struggle with my own passion for college football, because there are these stories just every year, all the time, of these kind of guys.
It's a great question. It kind of gets to what energized me when I took on the story as a book. In the first place, even if you do have a talent, you're not assured of anything. In the Memphis public schools, there was a study done a few years back by some of the football coaches, and they discovered that out of every six kids who were capable of going on to get, who had the talent to take full scholarships to play their sport in at college, five of them did not qualify academically and so never even went. So one in six got through with the talent. But what struck me about the story at the heart of The Blind Side was you have Michael Orr, who at the age of 15 is almost 6'6", 6'5½". He does weigh 348 pounds. They put him on a cattle scale at Briarcrest Christian School because he broke the ordinary one, and it isn't fat. He walks through the door. He hardly fits through the door. It's a width about him. He's got every athletic skill you'd like. I mean, he's got a hand-eye coordination. He's quick, fast. He's strong. It is about the most conspicuous package of athletic gifts that you could imagine, apart from maybe a 7 foot tall center in basketball.
Except again, you associate football as an aggressive game, regardless of what position you play.
That's true. He's not naturally aggressive might have put someone off. But just walking, the fact is, he's walking the streets, and that he's not grabbed by someone tells you something. That if this package of gifts would have been neglected, but for a series of incredible flukes. And Michael Orr was almost certainly on his way to gangs and jail. That's what happened to the people he ran with when he was little. And it just crossed my mind that if this package can be neglected, if Michael Orr's talents can be missed, as conspicuous as those talents are, what happens if the talents are less obvious? What if you were really born to play the violin or to trade bonds on Wall Street even? That you just know that there are there's the incredible wastage. The inner city America is like a machine for destroying value in people. And that animates this whole story. I asked, just to finish this, but I asked one of the Ole Miss football coaches, Ole Miss is where Michael is now playing football. I said, how much, if you could just had free run of inner city Memphis, how many kids just on the streets do you think could play for your football team? And he said, I don't think there'd be a lot of guys like Michael Orr who are that big, who didn't get noticed at some point or other. But I promise you that our entire defensive backfield and our wide receiver corps would probably be replaced. There's all kinds of talent that could have used that talent to get not just to play football, but to get themselves out of a bad situation and into a better one. And there are all these little barriers between them and the realization of that goal, so that for the most part they don't even try.
Talking again with Michael Lewis. His new book is The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game. Just if we can switch for a moment to baseball, one of our listeners says, since the release of your book, Moneyball, I'd like to ask if there are other baseball organizations that have adopted Billy Beane's approach to evaluating hitters. Are you kidding?
No. Well, Moneyball, you know, it's funny. Moneyball precipitated a holy war. I mean, the arguments about it inside baseball, a bit like the arguments between creationists and the evolutionary theorists, and there's no sort of persuading anybody.
Isn't it great to be the progenitor of that sort of thing?
Well, I feel like Billy Beane was, but the book threw gasoline on glowing embers. I don't know of anybody in baseball who was in a job of importance who read the book or who watched the A's and said, oh, we can learn something from this. That didn't happen. What happened instead was that owners had friends who, say, worked on Wall Street, who called them up and said, you know, Fred, you fool, look what they're doing with your money. You should pay attention to what the A's are doing. And the owner went into the front office and either fired his general manager or told his general manager to get with the program. And so, yes, there are a dozen more big league teams that have either replaced their general manager with a general manager who Billy Beane might have put in to the front office, who sort of sees the world in a very similar way, or who hired a staff of statistical analysts to help the general manager. So there has been change in the game.
Quick take from you on something before we go to more calls, just to follow through on the A's for a minute. Our engineer was saying to me before we went on the air today that when the A's won and clinched the title, all you could see was Lou Wolf. You didn't see much of Billy Beane.
He wasn't there. He didn't go up. And, you know, this is a very funny thing about Billy Beane. I'm to blame for this. But he got a reputation after the book came out of having this huge ego. And that this book happened because he had a huge ego. And people even accused him of having written the book.
Not that, like that at all, I can attest to.
Well, it's just he's a different ego. Yes, he has a big ego. He's an ambitious person, and he's an intelligent person, and he has great ambitions for himself. He doesn't really thrive on public recognition. He doesn't really care if he's on TV or in a book or any of that stuff. That doesn't really mean anything to him. You don't really see him out there on the camera and on the television during the games very often. And I think that, you know, he thought that it just wasn't his place to be there when they were celebrating. He was really pleased that the owner, he loves his new owner, I know that. And he was really pleased that the owner could have a winner, having suffered through a couple of not so good seasons.
A couple more emails. Here's Sasha from Berkeley. says, I'm wondering what reaction Michael Orr himself has had to your book and the way that you portray him. Alternately, what criticism have you received for your portrayal of Mr. Orr? Last week, I read your New York Times Magazine piece, The Ballad of Big Mike, and found your description of Michael Orr concerning. I realize that your description was a deliberate effort to highlight the unique position of a 16-year-old with such a lack of childhood and education, but your writing seemed objectifying, almost patronizing, as if Mr. Orr were a dumb animal.
Well, he didn't see it that way, and most readers didn't see it that way. But I suppose if you're looking for that, you might find it. He's what did he say? He said he thought it was a pretty good book, but he's not terribly interested in it. He wasn't terribly interested in being written about. I think that reaction to the Times excerpt was probably a reaction without maybe being completely aware of it to the fact that he was never quoted directly in a 10,000-word chunk about him. And that was because that was perfectly intentional. And it follows the way the book is laid out. Because Michael doesn't actually talk to anybody for the longest time when he walks into white Memphis. He really does not communicate. And everything I got from him was much later. So we get his point of view on things a lot later in the book, but it didn't, because that was a selection from early in the book, we didn't get his point of view. His point of view on his experience is curious, because he's not obviously grateful, as people might expect. I think he thinks, and I don't blame him for thinking this, that it took an awful lot of gumption for him to raise himself out of the circumstances into which he was born into these better circumstances, and incredible guts to be the one black kid sitting there not knowing anything in a classroom full of white kids who knew everything. And he was terrified, and he made himself go to that school anyway. At the same time, never once complained about the childhood he'd had, never once used it as an excuse for failure, never once used it in any way at all.
Is he also turned into a good Christian now? Is the Tui see things? Or?
Well, you know, Sean Tui says that he goes to church, that Michael goes to church just to please Leanne. And Michael doesn't talk about God a lot. So I don't know what he actually believes. He was a little coy with me. And if he actually had strong religious beliefs, I don't think he would be coy with me. I think he'd be happy to offer those up. But he is, to me, a portrait of stoicism, that it took great character on his part to behave the way he did, and at every right at the age of 16 to just give up.
Especially given how shy he was, almost pathologically shy, the way you portray him. Let me get more of our callers on. And Duncan, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Love the show. And I just wanted to ask, Michael, I've read a lot of your books. I think you're a great writer. And this was a fascinating article in that, and to me, after I read it, it was sort of open-ended. I wasn't sure. I mean, he's such a tragic figure, but I sort of feel as though, you know, he's sort of stepping into the lion's den. I don't get the sense that this guy is so developmentally, lacking, that, you know, he's going to have this support. And you mentioned how he doesn't look backwards. His past is almost irrelevant. But I think his past is so important to who he's going to be. And it's just sort of, I don't know, you look at some of the pro athletes who you feel are developmentally stable, and these guys can't even manage their careers. Sort of look at this guy as his future looks, I don't know.
This is like a kid. I think at one point you describe him, or somebody describes him in your book, as being like a kid who's been in a closet for years, literally, right. Locked in a closet.
One of the teachers at the Briarcrest School said that it was no different. They couldn't imagine a kid who had been locked in the closet for the first 15 years of his life would be that different. You've obviously read the excerpt in the Times Magazine of the book, so you got a little slice of it. You don't have the whole picture. But in fact, as the story unfolds beyond that, you see a couple of things happen. One, he does develop a lot from the age of 15 to 20 mentally and emotionally. And you see, I mean, I think a past is something that can be overcome, but I also agree that it's a tricky thing to escape. I'm ambivalent on this subject and ambivalent in the book. Because there are incidences that occur not so long ago with Michael where you feel like the past is kind of creeping up and biting him in the rear end. and that he can't quite get away from it. But
you know the old song, none of us can escape our childhood, right?
Yeah, but as far as his sort of ability to cope or function just practically going forward, I don't think there's any problem at all, because he now has an elaborate infrastructure of people who love him and who he loves, who know exactly what to do with business and with sports. And so, for example, I mean, he'll never be one of these guys who makes his $50 million in the NFL and then blows it all. That's not going to happen. And if he doesn't make it in football, he's not going to be one of these guys who's on the street. He's already got a career ahead of him in his adopted father's company.
You don't see him in bling bling and a Ferrari?
No, he's not that way. He's just not that way anyway. That doesn't interest him. So I think practically he's fine. I mean, practically I think he's going to have he'll have a very solid infrastructure going forward, and he's smart enough to use it. But the emotional and kind of psychological components of his life are a little trickier. I mean, I think that it's very hard. When I met him, he was 16. So I've known him for now three and a half years. When I met him, he had no awareness that his childhood was unusual or interesting. He was just being assimilated kind of into the white evangelical world. And he was just getting a sense of how other people lived. And he wasn't able to tell you what had happened in his childhood in an interesting way, because he didn't know what was interesting and what wasn't. He didn't know it was interesting that he was on the lam by himself for 18 months living literally on the street when he's 8 years old. He didn't think that was odd. But now, when you talk to him about it, he's much more articulate about it and understands that this was not normal. And he's kind of getting his mind around it. I'm sure there's some anger involved.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a minute. Here's an email from a listener up in Santa Rosa. It says, I wonder whether Lewis's book covers what the pressures do to young men and what the unfairness in which we are complicit also does to them. Does he explore the fact of the moral implications of taking babies trapped in men's bodies, holding them up as paragons, and then devastating them when they don't perform according to ideals we expect, but which they are not prepared to live up to?
Well, there's some truth to that. It is incredible to me, the pressures that are on. It isn't just athletes. I mean, life in this country has gotten so front-end loaded.
But this is a different kind of story. I mean, you think about Terrell Owens and what he's going through now and so forth.
This is not that story.
Or Mike Tyson.
This is not that story. But I mean, it is true that kids just generally have a kind of career pressure now that I didn't even experience growing up. I mean, these football players and other basketball and baseball players have it particularly. In this kid's case, he's now playing with a very comfortable safety net because he has a life to go to outside of it. And he knows that the love of his adopted family is not completely dependent on him playing football.
There's actually a moment in the book when he finds out his father dies, and of course he never really knew his father, knew who he was, but it's almost a relief to those around him because they figured this guy's not going to come in and try to cash in at a later date.
He'd basically not met his father. He met him in passing once or twice when he was very little, and he's at football practice, and he reveals to his adopted white father that they just
was
told
it Big Tony who told him? Or was
Big Tony.
3 months.
Yeah, the 3 months earlier, his father had been thrown off a bridge and murdered. And he had no particular feeling for his father, but he didn't understand why nobody had told him for 3 months.
We'll have to tease the listeners as to who Big Tony is.
Yeah, his adopted family, and he talked about it, and they agreed that look, this is not someone you had actually a relationship with. You are now all of a sudden this asset, you know, this asset that they didn't know he was when they got involved with him. And if he doesn't get hurt, you know, he might well take $100 million out of the NFL, and everyone's going to come out of the woodwork wanting something from him. And this was one person who was probably going to do that.
What about his siblings? What do we know about them?
Well, I spent a lot of time with, he has 12 of them. The girls, his sisters, were taken away at a very young age from the mother, and she doesn't even know where they are. And they're, I guess, four sisters. The brothers, he has relationships with most of them, and especially his older brothers. He has, I think, five older brothers. And I got to know the brothers. I interviewed all the brothers several times. But it's casual. I mean, and I think they think it's bizarre what's happened to him, because they all grew up in these kind of straitened circumstances, and they never left inner city, this little postage stamp in the middle of Memphis, and now Michael's got this life that is just, you know, unthinkably large to them. They talk some. Michael, every now and then feels resentful that his brothers didn't take care of him, because they were older and they could have done more for him, and that he was left to his own devices so much. I think he wonders how much he owes anybody. I know he wonders how much he owes anybody, because nobody really did things for him when he really needed it.
Let's get Corey on. Morning, Corey.
Morning. Michael, it was a terrific article. I read it. I haven't read the book. I read the article in the New York Times Magazine this weekend, and it's an uplifting story. But when I finished reading it, there was one small bit of minutia that bothered me, and that was the process by which Michael got his grade average to 2.65 or whatever it was.
I can understand why it bothered you.
Is this a legitimate process? Is it prevalent in the NCAA?
Bothered me too, actually.
Yeah. Well, it was. I mean, it's played partly for comedy in the article in the book, but it's an extraordinary look. Let me just briefly summarize it. Michael, the NCAA takes your ACT score, the ACT score of these athletes, and says, okay, given that ACT score, you have this as a grade point average, and if you don't have that, you can't go play. And he had gotten all F's and D's, all F's basically, for his first couple of years. And then when he finally was taken over and taken in hand by the TUIs, and his grades get up, it's not enough. It's too little, too late. He has all A's and B's his senior year, but it's still not enough. And so the only way they can get his grade point average up is to go to BYU correspondence courses and take one every 10 days and replace a high school grade with a correspondence course grade. And it is, yes, it's prevalent. It goes on everywhere.
You know, the whole story is a fascinating one. Michael Lewis' book, The Blind Side, Evolution of the Game. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Diana says, can middle schoolers read this book? Is it appropriate? The answer is yes. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.